From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, the human toll of China's earthquake, the Palestinian view of Israel's 60th anniversary, and Baroque music in the jungles of South America. In southwest China, police, soldiers and civilian volunteers are still searching for the victims of the recent massive earthquake. The death toll is climbing every day. The cost of the earthquake has been enormous, but the impact on individuals is sometimes lost in the huge numbers. This is a country which has pursued a one-child policy for years. Now many people are learning that that only son or daughter is dead. NPR's Melissa Block went to the city of Dujianyan, about 20 miles from the epicenter of the quake.
More than 600,000 people lived in the city of Dujianyan before the earthquake. Now, there is no telling how many are dead. Much of the city lies in ruins. Hospitals, schools, apartment buildings were flattened by the force of the earthquake. We end up driving through the city behind a rumbling excavator, and we find two people, a woman and a man, stumbling alongside it. They're clinging to the machine's lowered boom as if they could pull it by sheer human force to speed it through traffic. Please let us pass, they're crying. We have the excavator so we can save people. Our parents and our child are buried. Fu Guanyu and Wang Wei hop back in their tiny Suzuki, which they've abandoned in traffic. They lead the excavator on its way, and I climb in with them. She is 26, he's 34. It's Mr. Wang's parents who were buried, along with the young couple's son, Wang Zhilu. He's 2 months shy of his second birthday.
He's a lovely boy, and about 10 minutes before the happening of earthquake, he's calling me, Mom, please stay with me, don't go.
This past Monday afternoon, Mrs. Fu dropped her son off with his grandparents so she could go to her job at a department store. Then, just minutes later, the earthquake hit. She rushed back home and saw their apartment building in ruins. She says soldiers came right away to help, but they had no equipment. Now, finally, the heavy machinery is on the way.
It's been 2 days now, and you haven't been able to get any machinery to your house.
I still don't want to give up. I firmly believe he's still alive.
Finally, we pull up at the end of the alley that leads to the family's apartment building.
You're worried about this building over here? You're worried about this building falling down? There goes the excavator. You're worried that the shaking will harm this building, and this building here, this 10-story building, could collapse as the excavator goes by. We'll be careful. We're running down the alley to get by the building in case there's any fear of collapse. This 10-story building that's still standing. Headed down toward Ms. Fu and Mr. Wang's apartment building behind the excavator.
But there's still one more delay. There's a covered concrete gateway that's too low for the equipment to drive through. The claw of the excavator starts smashing the gate to bits.
Okay, the top of the gate is almost completely down. The whole 15-foot structure of cement and wire. Whoa! And down it comes in a huge crash. But this gate is down once they clear the debris away. Then the bulldozers can come in and the cranes to start picking through what's left of this family's building and try to find their child and the grandparents.
The family rushes toward the 6-story collapsed building at one end of a courtyard filled with trees.
Cement and bricks and rubble. It's a pile about 3 stories high, what's left of this building. All around it, there are buildings that are perfectly fine. That building is not at all fine. That building is gone.
We lived on the 4th floor, Mrs. Fu says. That's our furniture up there.
Oh, Mrs. Fu just called out her son's name, Huang, and said, "Mom is coming for you." As this excavator works its way through this pile of debris that is just devastating to look at.
When the excavator has cleared a path, Mrs. Fu and Mr. Huang run up to the debris pile.
Mrs. Fu is climbing up through sharp pieces of metal. She's calling out her son's name, Huang. She's peering through the bricks. Oh, the dad is now crawling deep under the masonry, and that's not safe. Mrs. Fu doubled over, shaking her fists, doubled over in terror, begging him to come out so that he wouldn't get hurt or crushed by these piles of debris.
The young couple climbs back down. There's so much heavy wreckage, it's useless. Work crews are brought in with torches to cut through rebar. The excavator starts back to work, and a bulldozer, and a crane. And after a long while, the workers stop. They have found some bodies.
Okay, we're standing on the edge of the rubble pile now, where they've clawed a big hole into this debris. There are flies buzzing around. People who were digging in here with the machinery came running out with their hands over their mouths. They have found a body. And I can see the hand now. In the rubble, there's a ring on the right finger. And there is no, there are no air pockets in this pile of rubble. This is just a mass of debris, and anyone in there has been crushed.
From the description of the ring, the Huang family can tell this is not their relative. It's a neighbor. There's some relief, but also now even deeper fear that this day will not end well. We are 50 feet away from the rubble pile, and now the smell of death is unmistakable.
These women have just brought Mrs. Fu a white sheet. They told her, "We hope they're still alive, but in case they're not, you can use this to cover their faces." It's a local tradition that others shouldn't see the faces of the dead, and now these women are tearing the sheet into three pieces for Mrs. Fu's family if they're found dead.
Mrs. Fu is trembling, and a friend wraps her in a tight embrace. "Don't cry, don't cry," the friend reassures her. "Maybe they didn't die."
Mrs. Fu is just limp with grief in her neighbor's arms. They want her to sit down and try to relax. She wants to stand right here and watch.
With the discovery of the bodies, about 30 members of the military police are brought in to dig by hand through the rubble. But these soldiers seem to have come with no equipment. Mrs. Fu and Mr. Huang rush out to buy supplies for them. They come back with packs of cotton gloves and face masks. Neighbors scramble to find shovels, and the soldiers head toward the pile.
Mrs. Fu started out this day saying she had great hope that her son was still alive. But with the discovery of these bodies now and the army here to pick through the rubble, the shrouds that are being brought in, you can tell that hope is just draining from her. She is limp. And her face is completely blank.
Hours crawl by. There is no news. Mrs. Fu and Mr. Huang fall into each other's arms.
It's now noon. We've been here for several hours. And Mrs. Fu has lost hope of finding her family, it seems. She's saying, "My son, I should have taken you to work with me. You were asking me to take you to work." Her husband is telling her, "There's nothing we can do about it now. I need you to stay strong. I can't lose you anymore." She has just collapsed in grief in her husband's arms as they both weep for what they've lost.
Then the police walkie-talkie crackles with a glimmer of hope.
They're trying to bring in sniffer dogs. They're trying to find sniffer dogs to bring in to see if there might be people still alive.
But soon enough, that hope is dashed too.
So some soldiers have just come in and have reported that they could not find any sniffer dogs.
At 4:40 in the afternoon, 9 hours after this day of waiting began, a worker comes out with news.
A worker just came out and said they had found the bodies of a child and two old people. And Mrs. Fu asked, was he a boy of about two? And the worker nodded yes. So they now know that their family has been found and they're all dead. Mrs. Fu just cried out her son's name and she said, Mama is here. The mother just called out to the worker, asking whether he had called out to the child, that maybe he had just fainted. The family was told later that their baby was found in his grandfather's arms, with the grandmother close behind, holding onto her husband's back. There have been so many deaths here in Dujiangyan that the crematories are full. People are being asked to take the bodies of their loved ones out to the countryside for burial. But Fu Guanyu and Wang Wei managed to get a local crematorium to come collect the bodies. They're driven away in a white van. Later, the family will burn paper money to usher the dead into the afterlife. They'll light incense and set off firecrackers to ward off evil spirits. Down the street, another family has begun the same ritual, this scene repeating itself countless times here in Dujiangyan, throughout Sichuan province, and beyond. I'm Melissa Block in Dujiangyan.
President Bush went to Jerusalem this week to take part in ceremonies marking the 60th anniversary of Israel's independence. Mr. Bush is trying to boost peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians. But most people on both sides of the divide now view the peace process with enormous skepticism. And a growing number of moderate Palestinians are now questioning one of the fundamental ideas behind the peace process, the idea of Israel and a Palestinian state living peacefully side by side. From Jerusalem, NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
Near the northern West Bank village of Beit Farik, an Israeli military checkpoint blocks a back road into the Palestinian city of Nablus. 50-year-old Aisha Abdul Karim, a diminutive Palestinian woman from the village, walks across a rocky olive grove with a giant satchel perched on her head. As she approaches the checkpoint, Israeli soldiers in full body armor stand behind thick cement barricades. A blue and white Israeli flag flutters above a gun tower. A few soldiers sling their M16s across their backs as they search cars, bags, and bodies, while others stand guard. Israel says these checkpoints are vital for state security. Aisha Abdul Karim, a farmer's wife, calls it the daily checkpoint grind.
Some days are easy, some days difficult. Other days are very difficult. It all really depends on the temperament and mood of the soldiers.
On this day, a baby-faced Israeli soldier seems to recognize Aisha. She presses the buzzer, what some Palestinians call the God finger, releasing a metal turnstile and allowing Aisha to pass through the first of a series of metal gates. Aisha's bag is then carefully searched by hand. 41 years after Israel captured the West Bank of the Jordan River in the Six-Day War, the banal routine of occupation is ingrained. Aisha, who's on her way to visit a relative near Nablus, seems resigned and defeated.
We've been living under occupation for the last 40 years. What can we do? We've gotten used to it.
Nearby, Israeli Naomi Levite, a retired schoolteacher, carefully watches every interaction at the checkpoint and jots down any delays or problems in a notebook.
The occupation feeds the hate. The whole occupation... It gets deeper and deeper, the hate.
Levite is with Checkpoint Watch, a group of Israeli women peace activists who volunteer to monitor some of what United Nations officials here say are now more than 600 Israeli obstacles to movement in the West Bank. Checkpoints, roadblocks, road barriers, earthen walls, and mounds. Levite, the retired school teacher, says she monitors the checkpoints to protest, to document, and to try to reach out to even one Palestinian who might only know Israelis through the heavily armed soldiers at the checkpoints.
And I know exactly that a minute later after I leave or an hour later it can be the same or worse, and I'm not doing who knows what. But what can I? I am an old woman. What can I do? And I have the feeling I have to do something.
It's not just the checkpoints. Palestinians and UN officials complain that continued expansion of Jewish settlements, the wall and barrier Israel is building in and around the West Bank, what Israel calls the security fence, and the checkpoints continue to slice the West Bank and villages around Jerusalem into separate cantons that undermine chances for a viable two-state solution. Ismail Khadan is the council president of Bido, a Palestinian village on the northwest outskirts of Jerusalem. He points to a new Israeli tunnel road that Palestinians in nine villages around Bido now must use to get to and from Jerusalem. Palestinians from here are not allowed on sections of a nearby Israeli highway.
This is a great example how villages like the ones we're standing here are cut off from the main cities, and how the whole homeland is being cut into isolated areas.
This Palestinian bypass tunnel road is the subject of several lawsuits in Israeli courts. Palestinians are suing for better access to Muslim holy sites in Jerusalem and for access to the nearby Israeli highway. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says their extensive surveys show that Israeli infrastructure in the West Bank today, including settlements, restricted roads, military posts, and closed military areas and more, now take up nearly 40% of the West Bank and put those areas largely off limits to Palestinians, according to the UN. Abdel Nasser al-Najjar, the managing editor of the Palestinian newspaper Al-Ayam, says all this fragmentation of the West Bank, combined with the takeover of the Gaza Strip by Hamas, have put the peace process on life support.
On life support, because there is no peace to the two states now. Gaza Strip divided from the West Bank, the wall, the settlements, the water, and the economic situation here means there is no opportunity for the two states to live together.
Add to those fears the conundrum of the Gaza Strip, controlled by the militant Islamists of Hamas, firmly opposed to a two-state solution and dedicated to Israel's destruction. All these gloomy facts have some Palestinian moderates trying to give new life to a very old idea, a single state for Jews and Arabs in historic Palestine.
The one-state solution is the solution, and the two-state solution is a dream.
For years, Hazem Qawasemi, an economist and former Palestinian Authority official, promoted the two-state goal, one Jewish, one Palestinian, living side by side in peace. But after the failure of the Oslo Accords, two Palestinian uprisings, and the Hamas takeover of Gaza, Qawasemi has thrown in the towel.
My conclusion, after 15 years working with Israelis, that the two-state solution is not going to happen. If you talk about the two-state solution in the Palestinian streets today, you will look as an idiot.
Qawasemi has just founded a new group in Ramallah called the One State Forum. Reviving the one state idea is somewhat radical. After all, militant groups Hamas and Islamic Jihad have their own one state goals, using force to create an Islamist state with an Arab majority, reclaiming historic Palestine from the Jews. But Qawasemi says he's promoting a progressive secular version of one state. A unified binational democracy, Qawasemi insists, will attract Israelis eager to shed the weight and trouble of occupation and fend off rising Islamist radicalism in the region.
We're talking about democracy. One person, one vote, equal economic, political rights. We're talking about equal rights. We're talking about no difference between Jew, Muslim, or Christian in one democratic state.
Israeli officials have long dismissed the one-state idea as demographic suicide that would undermine the Jewish majority and character of the country. As Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said in an interview with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz earlier this year, quote, if the day comes when the two-state solution collapses and we face a South African-style struggle for equal voting rights, the state of Israel is finished, Olmert said. Israeli political studies professor Gerald Steinberg says Palestinian leaders were never enthusiastic about a two-state solution. No Palestinian leader, he notes, has ever relinquished the demand for the right of return for Palestinian refugees from the 1948 war.
because the Palestinians have to say, we accept the right of the Jews to have sovereignty in part of this land, something that was never accepted 60 years ago, and that's been the core of the conflict since then. That change has not taken place in Palestinian society. And so since there was never really an acceptance of a two-state solution, now talking about missing the window for a two-state solution is really a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Two states will happen, Steinberg predicts, only when there is ripeness, recognition by both Palestinians and Israelis that all other options are far worse. And despite the fanfare of President Bush's current visit, he says, we're just not there yet. But it appears that some Palestinians are now turning from efforts to create an independent state toward renewed calls for equal rights in one state. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Coming up, the sound of music in the jungles of South America.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. Bolivia's Catholic missions, founded by the Jesuits in the 17th century, are the repository of a unique collection of lost music that's now been recovered and painstakingly restored. An international Baroque music festival in the missions is part of a revival of this musical tradition. As NPR's Julie McCarthy discovered, it's the children who are keeping this legacy alive.
Four Seasons by Italian composer Antonio Vivaldi leaps from the strings of the young musicians from the orchestra of the mission of San Jose de Chiquitos. Of the eight mission towns known collectively as the Chiquitania, each has spawned a youth orchestra. Tiny toes curl around chair rungs as the musicians, some as young as eight, play. They perform barefoot and wear simple garb to express their Indian heritage. Their musical tradition is a cross-pollination of the cultural impulses of Europe and the indigenous traditions of the Chiquitano, the original inhabitants of this steamy, lush lowlands. 16-year-old violinist Ariel Suarez says this Vivaldi piece, evoking a summer storm, is uniquely interpreted in the hands of musicians from this tropical spot. As if on cue, the rains begin. Here in Chiquitania, we have these intense downpours that suddenly let up. Then you'll hear this crackling bolt of lightning, he says. And those accents are what we think of when we play this piece.
The way they play here is different. No? We rehearse like 4 or 5 hours per day. That's why you have kids 8 years old playing Bach.
Director Santiago Lusardi of Argentina says besides a grueling schedule, the 30 members of his orchestra possess an innate talent passed down from earlier generations who first startled Europeans with their musical prowess.
In Europe, they really get surprised. They were discussing if they were people or if they were animals, but they were playing like people. So that's why they say they can't talk, but they can play like people, so they are people. It's incredible, but it was like this.
The choir and orchestra of the Mission of San Javier, established in 1691, the oldest of the Jesuit circuit. They perform beneath an altar alive with rose-cheeked cherubs, both ornate and innocent. The composer of this choral work is anonymous. The language is Guarani. Pietro Nowrot is a Polish priest and musicologist who meticulously reconstructed 27 volumes of the music here. He says much of the work is anonymous, and that the six original musicians brought here by the first Jesuits spoke Guarani, which is how the language got memorialized. Nowrot says the Jesuits used music as a tool of evangelization, but he says the indigenous populations themselves promoted the music once the Jesuits introduced it.
I believe we should never call this Jesuit missions. We should call it Guarani mission, Chiquito mission, the mission would belong to the people.
The Spanish crown ordered the Jesuits to quit the South American interior in 1767, less than 100 years after they arrived. Their musical legacy is housed here. In a sweltering room inside the Mission of Concepcion, restorer Juan Vaca flips through a reconstructed religious opera. The thousands of pages restored on Japanese parchment make up the largest musical archive of the Jesuits in the Americas and Asia. Project overseer Javier Mendoza says he gets nervous thinking about theft. Conductor Santiago Lusardi simply gets goosebumps looking at the archives.
Que podemos volver vivo un papel.
This is the magic of music right here, he says. You can take a piece of paper from 300 years ago and bring it alive again by playing the music that's written on it. You can relive what was happening in the past. The 1986 film The Mission, with Ennio Morricone's soaring score, stirred interest in the missions that stretched from Argentina up to the Chiquitania, a World Heritage Site today. Father Novrot says many of the centuries-old manuscripts he reconstructed were in the hands of ordinary people who stored them alongside precious heirlooms in simple boxes. Other scores turned up in dustbins in the back of forgotten church balconies. But Novrot says more commonly, people safeguarded the music and would tell him,
Father, if this is lost, if it dies, this tradition, we are all lost. We will die together with this manuscript. You see, this music was not just a music. It was a sacred music.
Each of the 45 groups in this year's festival performed a piece from Bolivia's archives. Audiences sit rapt for the Italian maestros. Italian Riccardo Simeon plays cornet in the Milan-based ensemble. As the children of the missions perform Baroque masters, he's transfixed.
Some people say this place is so exuberant that the Baroque aesthetic fits perfectly well into it. For us, it's a journey into the Baroque world more than into the jungle.
70,000 visitors were drawn to this year's Baroque Festival in Bolivia's missions, relishing in the music that this remote corner of the world is reclaiming. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Concepcion.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.